Hello, this is Daniel Jalkut.
Hi, this is Manton Reese.
And this is Core Intuition, Some Little Achilles Heel Thing. Manton, it is like 90 degrees here, and I have done you the courtesy. No, I've done our listener the courtesy. Our listeners the courtesy of turning off my AC. I'm situated in our dining room because I hate myself so much that I don't grant myself the luxury of AC in my home office. But today is such a special hot day here in Boston, and my wife is out of town, and I've been taking care of the kids by myself, so I have complete control over the apartment, and I decided, oh, I'm going to set myself up in the once air-conditioned dining room, quickly becoming steamy again. How are you doing down there in Austin?
Doing good. It's raining all week here. It's very strange. So it's not hot for once.
That's very strange.
Doing good. Staying busy. I am working on, seems like 5 things at once. But one of those I'm working on a lot, going to ship this week, I think, which is finally giving TweetMarker, the TweetMarker API, some attention. I launched it 2 years ago, about 2 years ago. And it was free, and you know, we've talked a little bit on the show off and on about how I've got to make money from it and actually get it to be profitable. And I'm finally rolling out a kind of a developer plan for developers to kind of kickstart it a little bit again, get some more attention to it, and be able to work on the API a little more.
Well, you don't have to make money from it, Manton. it's purely optional. You know,
I'd like not to lose money on it.
Apparently, you know, if there were a rule that you have to make money from these kinds of pursuits, then there would be a lot of rule breakers out there.
Yeah, it's good though. I mean, you know, last week we were talking about how it's nice to work on things that you're actually going to ship. It's also nice to work on things that are not complete money pits. You're writing a check to your hosting company every month, and it's not really balancing out in a positive way. So I've been working on that. I've been excited about that. Actually, it's been too long, I think, since I've just been in kind of maintenance mode with that. You know, I mean, I work on it a lot.
Yeah,
and I moved servers about a month ago, 2 months ago.
Right, to save your monthly costs. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And that was great. But I feel like most of the time I put into it, and I hate this kind of stuff where you put all these hours into it, and what do you have to show for it? Well, the API is the same.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe it's faster. Maybe it's more robust. But it's always nice when I can put a lot of hours into something and actually have something significant to show where users actually benefit in some way, instead of just kind of, you know, spinning the wheels and doing a lot of work that is just to keep up with things actually running smoothly.
Yeah, I've been having a little bit of a first world existential self-employed indie developer crisis because along those lines, I think, ask me on a different day and I will tell you that like my main priority is either to make a ton of money,
mm-hmm,
or to ship something so I can basically show off what I can do to everybody in the world and get some, you know, gratification that way.
Okay.
Or
you've done that, though. Yeah. People are already impressed.
Well,
with what you've done.
Yeah.
You don't need it. You don't have any, anything to prove anymore.
What have you done for me lately is what I imagine. I guess that's my own self-assessment. But then the other thing is just being a relatively successful indie software developer, I can get drawn into that. Well, forget about money. Forget about shipping something that you know is going to get me recognition or make me feel like I'm helping the world. Oh, what do I just feel like doing today? You know, that's the deadly one. Mm-hmm. What do I feel mm-hmm. like doing today? Nobody who has a real job gets that luxury or that pitfall, really. I mean, they may, but then they get fired or something, right?
Or something great happens. So, you know, you have companies that respect that enough where they do the 20% time, or they...
Yeah, or at least they have lip service about 20% time.
Yeah, right? Exactly. But, you know, some of the best ideas come up with that kind of, I'm just goofing off and I stumbled upon something amazing that no one in a meeting of 20 people and a couple executives would have come up with. But one hacker off alone, working on whatever he feels like, comes up with something great.
One hacker doing what he or she was not supposed to do saves the company. And I think that's what I'm vainly hoping I'm doing for Red Sweater every day when I sit down and work on some random thing that's unrelated to the previous day's work.
Yeah.
What's actually new with this tweet marker work you've been doing? What's the breakthrough?
The breakthrough is just charging developers. For the longest time, I didn't charge anybody. The whole thing was free, and I just kind of got donations from people. And early on, I got developers to donate some money, and that was great. But as things kind of turned on, I was just basically running it as a community service. You know, it was there wasn't any income coming from it. I did add a subscription for users, $1 a month, several months ago, maybe earlier in the year. And it's optional, and it's most people don't do it. Most people don't know about it. And so the change that I'm doing this week is making the API more official. So instead of you asking for access and I give you access and I say, have fun, you actually register and you pay every month and you're part of like the official program to build apps for the TweetMarker API.
So did you end up having to give existing developers a kind of ultimatum, like, it's been fun, but as of this date, like, are these folks who already were using the API, are they going to have to start paying you, or is there like a grandfathered?
Yeah, this part is a little bit not 100% clear. Like, I haven't drawn like a line in the sand yet. I gave a couple developers that were real early supporters heads up months and months ago that I was thinking about doing this. And most of the developers knew that I was thinking about doing this even 2 years ago. I'd always planned to have some kind of program like this. But I'm not going to shut anybody off because that would be so user hostile having apps break. I'm not going to do that, but I am going to strongly encourage everyone to do this.
Right.
And if enough do, then I'll say, hey, you know, I'm willing to let slide a couple things if people don't join the program, as long as it's enough. But I also added this twist that I think is going to work. I'm not entirely sure, but I'll present it to you. You tell me if you think it's a good idea. I added a referral program also. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is, so let's say the developer plan is like $75 a month to be a Twitter developer. And, you know, you pay to have access to this. For every user you refer to the dollar a month, you know, subscription plan, I mark that off your monthly charge. So if you refer people to pay in user accounts, it's effectively free or cheap. That was kind of the breakthrough, I guess, if there was anything
interesting
in trying to make it.
And that's like on a monthly basis. Like, they don't have to scramble like every month to get new users. Like, if they get 75 users total, let's just say your fee was $75 a month, and they I sign up for TweetMarker, you're going to charge me $75 a month. But if I get 75 of my users to commit to $1 a month, then I'm home free
as a developer.
Oh, but as long as so it's not on ongoing.
Well, I guess I could.
Well,
do it that way.
I'm not trying to push you that way. Maybe that's the way to lose a lot of money. I don't know. I'm not saying that that's the smart way. But okay, so you're saying it's a one-time $1 credit when.
Well, you know, I guess I could go either way. That my plan was to do it every month. I would see how many people you referred, and then I would go in and I would subtract it. But I guess I could do it either way, and I would still come out ahead.
There's something elegant in my mind, to the idea of, you know, the developer is sort of saying like, I'm fronting for my users, you know, like I realize this costs money. I need to like help Manton Reese survive. I am fronting the expense for my users in the hope. And then I'm going to hope that my users like come through and pay their own way. And that's kind of like what happens with it. I guess that's kind of what it would be if you did the approach where it's like, okay, if a TweetBot uses TweetMarker and it's $75 a month, and then they get 75 users to join up, then I don't know. It's interesting. So something else is you want to incentivize the developer to continue trying to get people to sign up, right?
Yeah, because people will drop off. That's the thing. If I did it at one time, yeah, which you first assumed, and let's say one developer got 75 exactly.
Yeah.
I'm like, great, it's free for the month for you. I mean, it's free forever for you, right? But then 6 months down the line, what if people cancel and there's only 50 active users?
Yeah.
Right, then I start
complicated.
To...
You get, Manton, yeah, why do you pick such complicated...
I know.
You should write Mac, write Mac apps.
Well, you know, that's actually funny you say that, because I've come to the same realization. I mean, I'm working on this thing because I want to do this kind of last ditch. Like, I'm doubling down on TweetMarker. I want to do this work, and I want to make it better. And I have some API improvements that I'm adding at the same time. I'm adding like stats and charts and things for developers so they can get like kind of access to some of the information that I've been collecting from this whole time. So I'm adding this stuff. I'm like, this is my chance to really make this work again. But at the same time, I realized that I do need to get back to Mac development, because things were a lot simpler when I was doing Mac development than when I'm running web services. And so I've actually been doing Mavericks in particular has gotten me really excited about resurrecting my Mac app Clip Start and doing a 2.0 version of that. And I've been actually doing a lot of work on that and really excited about shipping that, hopefully, when Mavericks comes out.
Yeah, and a lot of things have changed since you abandoned the Mac. Like, we have a thing called Xcode now. We're not using Project Builder anymore.
I thought you were going to say Code Warrior.
We're not using Code Warrior. We have this thing called Coco now. It's kind of like Carbon, but, well, it's a little bit different.
Ouch. Well, the funny thing is that it hits home because...
Because you're still working on a Carbon app.
Well, there's a lot of Carbon in Clipstart, and I wouldn't say a lot, but there's a little bit of Carbon, and there's a lot of QuickTime.
Oh, right.
One of the things that I just had to bite the bullet and go for is I had to just scrap all that code and rewrite some things so that I could bring the app to sort of the modern architecture. So the new version is going to require 10.8. It's going to be 64-bit finally. And moving to 64-bit does require taking some of that old QuickTime stuff, some of those little Carbon, you know, functions that are scattered through the app, and getting rid of those. And so it's a process. It actually has gone much better than I thought it would. I was really worried about finally making the transition, but... It's been all right.
Yeah. Well, I've been doing similar work because I finally decided to start tackling some of my, the deprecations that 10.8 brought. Like, that 10.8 was like, they finally said, hey, Carbon Core, not cool. Right. And like, yeah, Carbon Core was the little pro Mac developers, Swiss Army knife. Mm-hmm. Like, if you came into Mac development at 10.0, 10.1, 10.2, 10.3, 10.4, 10.5, 10.6, 10.7, and you didn't even think that there was a possibility that you should use ever any functions in, like, well, first of all, Core Foundation, but actually in, you know, sometimes Carbon Core, you were at a serious disadvantage to other developers on the platform, because some things just simply were not possible unless you knew you could kind of sink down to that level. So when I started seeing all this stuff, like, oh, they're finally deprecating like aliases, the alias mm-hmm. manager. And I'm like, this is not going to be pretty. This is not good. Like, because I'm just thinking, oh, they probably just no disrespect to my friends and some of them former peers at Apple who worked on these deprecations. And I know how it goes. Like, you don't always see what all the, needs are of the developer community while you're making these decisions inside Apple. And I was a little pleasantly surprised, I have to say. It sounds like similarly to you that some of this stuff was actually covered better than I worried it was going to be. And, like, you know, I've been like in the dark here. I've been like, oh, what is this? You know, I only knew about this so-called bookmarks concept mm-hmm. in, because of the context of sandboxing.
Right.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, this thing, bookmarks, is not for sandboxing. It's, you know, it's like the wholesale replacement for the Alias manager that came in, I think, 10.6.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just this is the classic problem for us, Manton. Like, limited time because we're spending all our time on podcasts, and then Apple constantly growing and evolving our frameworks. And well, come to find out, finally, this push to deprecate all this old Carbon Core stuff has I guess you and I kind of coincidentally at the same time chipping away at this stuff. And it's gonna feel good though. It's gonna be like, I already feel like, you know, there have been a few compromises I had to make where I was like, okay, well, like, for example, I can't write Alias data back to my preferences file in such a way that somebody who then downgraded from my app back to an old, you know, 10.4 compatible version would still be able to read it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, oh, you know what? That's the kind of thing I need to get over, because like I worry right. way too much about that kind of stuff. And in a sense, like, it not being even possible with the new APIs, it's like, well, all right, I got to move on.
I've been thinking about some of those same kind of things with, you know, I just said I'm calling this new version 2.0, and it makes some decisions about doing things a certain way, whereas before I might have done things like three different ways depending on what the user wanted and what their preferences were set up to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I've thought about being a little bit hard about what types of setups I'm going to easily transition to 2.0. Like, it might be that you might need to do a little bit of work to upgrade. It might not just be like every, because the 1.x versions of ClipStart were fairly flexible in terms of how you wanted to manage videos. And early on, I got some feedback that maybe it was too flexible. Maybe it should have just been one way. And so I'm thinking about kind of having it, without going into too many details about what I'm thinking about, I'm thinking about simplifying it a little bit, but just make it work a lot better in 2.0. And so how I handle transitioning 1.0 customers is going to be really interesting.
Yeah, well, I face the same kinds of problems. I'm always like, I see it like as at the end of the world if I can't like seamlessly transition people. And it's like, well,
yeah,
you know, like I've hollered about problems with sandboxing where it's like, oh, I won't be able to take my customers from this version to that version. And yeah, it's like, well, you know what? At the end of the day, I had an export, you had an import, and people have dealt with this problem before, you know?
Yeah, and I was even thinking about doing, like, you start up 2.0. Maybe this is crazy, but it kind of defaults to the new way that I want people to think about the app. And then you could, like, if you had an existing install, you could just kind of like drag it in or something, and then it would, you know, it would suck in all your old, you know, library and all your old settings. I don't know. I've been trying to think about different ways to handle that, because I want to encourage a certain way of working with the app, because I think it'll work a lot better and be a better app.
Right.
There's certainly, as I'm going through this, and like you mentioned the Alias, it's funny, I'm working on kind of the same things. I mean, in my database, I have, you know, video, it's a video library, and I have paths to videos, and I also have, I store Alias records like in the database,
right?
So that I can also find things.
You and I are more alike than we might have ever known. I mean, of course, we both store Alias records in our preferences.
How else would you?
And like, we're the two software developers it's us two, Manton, and the one mm-hmm. guy at Apple who actually added the API call to convert raw Alias record data into a bookmark.
Right.
So
I've been pleasantly surprised, actually. I thought it was going to be a little more difficult, and I'm not done, so I may hit some roadblocks that Apple hasn't thought about. But I think this is another case of, if I had tried to do this in 10.6, if I had tried to go to sandboxing, which I hated the concept of sandboxing so much, it actually drove me out of the Mac App Store. Listeners may have remembered.
Right.
I think if I had tried to do this earlier, it would have been very difficult. But the fact that I'm waiting and actually requiring 10.8
yeah.
is making some of this a little bit smoother.
So, Manton, I don't want to go on and on and on and on about your new ClipStart 2, but does that mean you're going to end up coming back to the App Store?
No.
No.
No, because even as I said, I'm trying to simplify the app in certain ways. I mean, it's adding features. It's in some ways it's more complicated, but it's simplifying how you think about
yeah.
The way the app works. even though I'm doing that and this would be a great time to adopt sandboxing, there is still a lot of problems with doing that. So one of the things I've been experimenting is Dropbox support in the app directly. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, if I do sandboxing, well, you know, I'd have to use the Dropbox API instead of being able to use the file system. And, you know, I mean, there's all sorts of, things I'd run into with the way I want to access files that I don't think I'm going to come back to the Mac App Store.
Yeah, well, you said it with such resolve. It was clear that you had thought about it and you weren't like, well, no. You were just like, no. Answer is no. Yeah. That has been rehearsed. It's like you're a PR agent for Riverfold Software.
I have a clear message with that. But I just don't. I'm having so much fun, you know, booting into Mavericks and working on. By the way, I kept saying just now, I'm catching myself. I said requires 10.8. This will require 10.9, not 10.8. Going Mavericks only right. for this release. But I'm having so much fun working on that, and I know that if I go to the Mac App Store, all that fun is going to slip away. I'm going to spend all my time working on things I don't want to work on. I'm going to be spending time on sandboxing and weird compatibility things, and I would rather do all the things I love about this app, build the app that I want to use, and be able to ship it to my customers anytime and just, you know, not deal with
right.
that. With the red tape.
Cool. Well, you know, you can always decide later to change that approach, and it's always best, I think, to serve your fluidity of your development and actually encourage yourself to do the work that you want to do. And it sounds like that all that backbending to accommodate the Mac App Store would be a direct conflict with that goal.
Yep. Okay, this week we are sponsored by Crashlytics again. Thanks for sponsoring the show. Crashlytics is a lightweight framework for iOS and Android for getting crashes reported in your apps. When your iPad or iPhone app crashes go up to Crashlytics server right away. You can log in, you can filter them by version of your app. You can see what version of the OS people are running. They also have a nice little Mac app that sits in your menu bar. And your crashes are right there. So you can click on it, see popular crashes that are aggregated together. And that app also helps you configure Xcode projects. So it's really easy to get running. I've been using this in Tweet Library for a long time now and really happy with it. It works really well. Solid app. And so thanks, Crashlytics, for sponsoring again this week.
Yeah, you know, Manton, it's kind of fun for me because Crashlytics has, you know, always been based here in Cambridge in the Boston area. And when they were acquired by Twitter, Twitter, thankfully, I think, for the people who worked here and wanted to stay here, they just decided to, you know, keep Crashlytics here. And it's really been like part of the basis of this growing Twitter Boston office. And, you know, if you were a little pessimistic or cynical about the situation when Twitter acquired Crashlytics, you might have assumed like, oh, well, you know, this is maybe one of the, maybe this is one of those acqui-hires and like they don't really care about crash reporting services. But it's really cool to see how the Twitter Boston office based here in Cambridge is growing. And looking at the Twitter, if you go to twitter.com/jobs, you can see that like there are a ton of jobs in the Boston area working for Twitter. And it's kind of cool that they're growing, and many of them are for Crashlytics. So, like, occurred to me, Manton, some of the folks listening to this show either live in the Boston area or would be interested in relocating here. So, worth mentioning, I think, that some of the people listening to this show are probably ideal candidates for some of these jobs. They got jobs listed up there like analytics engineer, Android engineer, iOS engineer, iOS product manager. And even stuff that's not engineering per se, like developer relations, stuff like that. So obviously, Twitter's acquisition of Crashlytics has not led to any slowing down of Crashlytics development and growing the product. And if you happen to be really interested, maybe you've become a fan of Crashlytics from listening to this show. And if you're enough of a fan, maybe you should go work there. It's a possibility.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's great. Glad to see they're growing, still going strong. So thanks again for sponsoring the show, and you can check it out at Crashlytics.com.
And once again, the jobs site, if you're interested in that, is twitter.com/jobs, and then just search on the open positions for the Boston area. Well, Manton, I think everybody listening to this show, hundreds, thousands, perhaps millions of other people were surprised to see this week that Apple had evidently put up all of WWDC's 2013 videos on YouTube.
Yes, that was a big surprise.
It was a surprise for a reason.
Yeah, Apple was also surprised that they did that. And so they're down now. They seem to be up for only a day that I noticed, but I think they were up a few days before that, before anyone actually noticed that this had happened. But it was a really interesting experiment. I'm glad that whoever did it did it, because it was a neat way to compare the Apple experience of watching videos to the YouTube experience. And, you know, I think Apple has done an excellent job with videos this year, but it's not a perfect job. And I think there are things that YouTube does better than the Apple developer site. One of the things that I was really fascinated with is transcripts. Google has some magic where they like auto caption videos somehow, right? Mm-hmm. And so you can actually, like on the WWDC sessions, I pulled one up and I clicked on transcripts or whatever the tab was, and the text of the whole session was right there, and I could like use Command F to like find the topic I wanted and jump right to a section of the video. And it wasn't perfect, you know? I mean, it was a machine did this, so there were a lot of mistakes. And some of them were, you know, ridiculous and, you know, didn't make any sense. But it worked well enough that I think that's an example of something that you get with something like the videos being on YouTube that you don't get normally. Other thing, like linking to parts of a video also just, I mean, I don't know, there's a lot of advantages to having them just out there.
Yeah, and, you know, full credit to Apple for having the machine of, you know, being able to train all of these employees to do these talks, to rehearse them, to have, you know, like outsource to, you know, presentation specialists to make like great slide art, all this stuff, to have it all come down to like a 4-5 day performance period, and then to be recording and then publicizing the videos within 24 hours.
Yep.
All extremely admirable stuff. That nonetheless doesn't help the experience of trying to then queue up and watch the videos and enjoy the videos afterwards. I mean, we talked about this a few episodes ago, I think, where I was like, well, how do you actually do that? Like, I used the WWDC app to star all these sessions, and those stars are useless to me now because, you know, I go in to like try to watch these videos now on the Apple homepage, and it's like, oh well, I gotta go
what stars?
Yeah, I gotta go cruise for like session numbers, and you know, you're sometimes like somebody will say you have to watch session 309. Mm-hmm. Like, oh god, how do I find what session 309 is?
Right.
And sometimes people will say you have to watch session called blah de blah. You know, I have no idea how to find that. Worst thing, of course, is somebody will say you have to watch Joe Schmo's session.
Right.
They don't even publicize that. That's not even like,
Yeah. And that's such an easy thing they could do. I would love to know the presenter names and the description. Yeah. I mean, why not do that?
It's part of the metadata of the video, right? I mean, it's not like they make it's like the first slide you see on the video when you watch it.
Right.
This is Joe Schmo from the QuickTime group telling you that you abandon all hope, your 32-bit app is screwed. And
the slides reminds me of one thing I wanted to mention. If this is a little bit of a side note, but if you listeners don't know this, the PDFs of all the presentations are available for the slides, and that's a really fast way to skim through a session to see if it's actually what you thought it was before you watched the video.
Definitely, so, yeah.
Quick tip if you haven't seen that. But, you know, as you were talking about the like all the work they put into preparing for WWDC and then being able to get those session videos out like literally within hours practically, I feel like it's such a shame that like the web technology and sort of the apps and the infrastructure are holding back all the great work that Apple did on WWDC. And this is kind of, I don't know, kind of a classic Apple thing where they do great work, but then there's some little Achilles heel kind of thing that holds back the potential. And a lot of times it's the web stuff. There's nothing wrong with the developer site and the video site, but it could be so much better and provide so much better access to the videos.
Yeah, well, there is something wrong with it. There's a lot of things wrong with it.
Well, I mean, it's for what it is, you know, works. It's not like buggy or something.
No, right. It is executed for what it is. It is executed.
Yeah.
And but it also reminds me, for example, of developer forums, right? Like developer forums is an incredibly polished subpar solution. Right, right. Like every time I go in there, I'm like, somebody worked on this a lot, just to be this thing that frustrates me and makes me wish Apple could make like a licensing deal with Stack Overflow.
Right. Oh man, that would be.
Wouldn't it be incredible if Apple and Stack Overflow were like, you know what? Because I understand the reason that, you know, all this stuff can't just go to Stack Overflow is because of NDA stuff. But what if it was just like, you know what, Stack Overflow and Apple announce the developer program private Stack Overflow?
Yeah, yes and no, though, because like that would be great and an improvement over the existing dev forums. But it would be a step back in that it would hide all this behind a login. And, you know, getting back to the videos, this is one of the great things about YouTube is that they're not hidden. You could link not just to the video, but you could link even to like 20 minutes into the video, right? And so the Stack Overflow thing would be great, but it would be a step back in that it wouldn't be indexed by Google.
Well, it would be a step back for non-NDA material. And it would be a step forward for NDA material. So you're getting at the problem, which is, and this came up like on Twitter actually the last few days in response to this WWDC thing, because people started asking like, well, why the heck is this NDA still in effect? Because anybody can get access to it. You know, Cable Sasser from Panic was asking about this on Twitter, like, well, seriously, though, like anybody can get, you know, Samsung can go sign up for an ADC account and have access to all this.
Yeah, it's silly.
But it's some the sort of conclusion I came to and that some other folks seem to come to is like the presence of an NDA serves Apple on a legal basis in some way, I think, to the extent that it gives them a stick to beat anybody who behaves in such a way that they don't like, you know, or
so one of those discussions on Twitter I found really interesting though, and that was David Bernard posed the question of legally, if someone puts all this out there, is it okay to talk about it? Like the entire contents of WWDC was put out in the public every minute, right? So legally, does the NDA still apply? You know, I mean, if you think about a normal kind of, you know, I mean, I don't know. It's just like the whole thing was leaked. And whether that was, you know, in violation of the NDA or not, it happened.
Yeah.
And so, you know, how can anyone be stopped from talking about this when it is all in the public?
I think that's very tricky, especially when the information has been, revoked, or you know, it's been it's been brought back into secrecy. So, like, if you are if you are a person who did not notice that all of these videos had been released and didn't jump onto YouTube and download every single video, then you did not have any of that information disclosed to you. And so this is tricky. Yeah, this is big time. We are not lawyers moment, but there's something to these NDAs. The way I've always understood them is that the NDA is sort of non-applicable only when the information has become like quote unquote common knowledge. And you know, I think there's an argument to be made for that. Like a lot of just like a lot of just like the careless chatting about iOS 7 that's happened on Twitter and on blogs and on even like reputable tech sites has either inadvertently or, you know, with some like knowing carelessness divulged things. And then I think, yeah, once it's like on macworld.com or Ars Technica, Mac Stories, you know, these sites that like have a huge readership, and if it's on there and it hasn't been retracted by legal force, I think it's reasonable to talk about it. But, you know, I think it's a little bit different when you sort of happen to be the witness of a mass violation of the NDA. And you know that.
And in this case, it's not really just an NDA violation, but like a, probably a huge copyright violation as well. So it's, it's no good for sure. But yeah, I think the NDA is ridiculous personally. And I blogged about this years ago. When you have hundreds of thousands of people have access to this information, it's not a secret. Everyone knows.
Yep.
So, and I think it's silly to jump on developer friends when they talk about it, saying, you know, this is, you know, we see this all the time. Someone mentions something and then someone will reply and say, you can't do that. Right.
Yeah.
I think that is silly. It's not our job to police, you know, Apple's thing. But having said that, I do think we need to be careful because Apple has been extremely generous this year with the information coming out of WWDC and the access to the dev forums, even if you weren't an attendee, for example. So I do think we should be careful that we don't go too far because they, at any time they could say, yeah, forget it. You know, we're going to pull this back and we're going to be real secretive about this again. And so we should use good judgment about how we talk about it.
As a community, we need to, preserve this respect that if we want to be respected by Apple, we have to give them a little respect. That seems reasonable to me. You know, I've always been, it's partly because it's, so to speak, in my DNA to be respectful of Apple's NDA from working there, you know, but
sure.
It really is no sweat for me to follow the letter and the spirit of the NDA because I get it that it's frustrating. You know, thinking about this, Manton, like we're living in a golden age of NDA-based collaboration because remember, it wasn't that long ago that there was no sanctioned forum for discussing NDA materials with other developers.
Yeah.
And now you can do that on the dev forums. You know, there are there are specific dev specific forums. And I think actually this year they changed it. So like basically the whole forums are opened up to NDA stuff.
Yep.
They just said, you know what, if you're in here, like go wild. But
exactly. Which is great. Yeah. I think that's the right thing to do. And exactly. And then my point is, they've made such progress with mostly making this a non-issue that we shouldn't be, we shouldn't be too,
it does. Yeah. It doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother me too much. However, it does bother me that I can't like I here's a good example, Manton. I actually find it pretty convenient that I can link to the dev forums on Twitter and I can say, you know, Apple ID required in parentheses. And but that's still that ability to canonically link to, say, a question I've asked about some NDA issue or an answer I've received. Essentially what you are hoping for, and what I'm hoping for, if we accept that the NDA is there to stay and we have access to these videos that are covered by an NDA, what you and I and everybody else would like is the ability to say, here is, you know, the moment 34 minutes and 17 seconds into a session at WWDC 2013 that answers this question.
Yeah, exactly.
Link to it. And then, yes, it's fine. If you link to it and then somebody clicks on it, goes to apple.com and they say, sorry, you can't see this unless you sign in with your Apple ID.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. The problem is that in this particular case, the fact that we have an NDA is preventing us from linking and talking about this stuff.
Right.
Not talking about it. Linking to it in a productive way. Like, it's holding the whole system back. It would be not a completely non-issue, but it would be less of an issue if Apple had the best,
right,
you know, access to videos, linking to videos, you know, all this kind of thing.
You would think they should have that kind of thing, given that they are a, you know, multimedia company that pioneered video with QuickTime and right. now like dominates music and sales and is a major player in TV and movies. You would think that they might have some of the same kinds of collaborative movie sharing techniques that YouTube has. But as far as I know, you can't even like even when you go back to like when, you know, you used to be able to just watch these WWC videos in iTunes. I don't I don't think I can send you even an iTunes link that has like 30 minutes and 13 seconds in.
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think there's any URLs for any of this. It's all hidden behind Ajax-y fanciness.
Yeah, get on that, Apple. You heard us.
And while you're at it, also search, you know, present.
Oh, are we making a list? Names.
Yeah. filter by category. So there's a long list of things that I would love to see.
Well, we are very lucky, Manton, to be developers in Apple's ecosystem. I try to remind myself that as often as I can, because it's one of those things like the Mac, like the iPhone, like the iPad. All of these platforms, I think, are analogous in that way that the fact that they are so good is what makes it so easy to pick nits about little things here and there. And I'm really grateful that as a person who didn't pay any money for WWDC, I can go to a web page because I paid $99 and maybe I heard something like you didn't even have to have a paid account anymore to, I don't know. I can go to a web page at Apple and stream for free the content of any session at this $1,600 conference.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I should put my complaints on the shelf for a little while.
It's great. It's great. No question. So interesting still, the YouTube experiment. I'm glad it happened, whoever did it.
Yes. Yeah, so, well, it's interesting. When you said that, I'm glad it happened. The idea that jumped to mind was the concept that jumped to mind was civil disobedience.
Yeah. Well, the other interesting thing here is that, like, whoever did this.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not convinced they weren't at Apple. Like, it took an enormous amount of bandwidth to upload high quality videos of all these. I mean, I couldn't do this.
Well, why not? People could download high quality videos of all of them.
Well, I mean, your upload speed would have to be something incredible.
Yeah.
Like, to be, I don't know. I haven't calculated it. I think someone did a rough guess, but, it would be difficult to upload all these, I think. No? I mean, how many hours of
videos
are
there? What's the total size? It's like it's gigabytes, but it's not like... It's
definitely gigabytes. Okay, I don't know. Maybe I should have calculated before I said anything. I think it was someone with a very great network.
I don't think it's that hard to come across those networks these days. Like, and in fact, the people who are most likely to be civil disobedience... are probably the most likely to have access to those kinds of networks, like college students who are on like funky, like Internet 2, you know, like, I don't know, people who like work at some college affiliated with, you know, some college that has like contracts with DARPA, right? They probably got a real fast internet. You know what I mean? Like,
maybe it's not that big of a deal. It seems like a major task to upload all that, but
it's a task for sure. I'm not sure that the bandwidth is the big task. Like it's a series of little there's a series of tasks that like certain people would be excluded from being able to make it happen. Like if you happen to live in Montana on DSL, you're not going to be the hero here. But
let me rephrase it this way. Although I think it's still a big deal. But let me rephrase it in that someone went to a lot of trouble to do this. Like this isn't something you could just do in a day.
And it was done. What was so interesting was actually that it was done with such a lack of fanfare that it made it look plausibly official.
Right.
And nobody said, like, ha ha, you know, I pwned Apple. I uploaded all the WWDC videos. They're just like, Apple WWDC videos now available for your viewing pleasure. And in fact, the person who shared the news first that I saw was Federico Vitici, who had taken the news, I think, from Timothy Hatcher. I think that's his name. Xenon. He's one of the WebKit developers. He does a WebKit Inspector. And he had shared the link on Twitter saying, and he's an Apple employee, you know, says, good news, like, Apple, or no, he said, good news, WWDC videos are on YouTube. Here are a couple links to great talks about the Web Inspector.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that's what gave Federico, I believe, the sort of, it sort of implied some possibility of it being official.
Right.
And the account on YouTube was so sparing. It looked very Apple. You know, they did a good job of faking. Yeah. And so maybe.
Well, and it was correct, too. Yeah. It was like the titles were there. It was consistent.
The description was cheesy, just like Apple would have made it. It was like unlocking the revolution of the future of, right, you know, mobile development. You know, it's like something. It was something.
Yeah.
It was something marketing-y.
Yeah. All the best videos now on YouTube. Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, well, Manton, we lost our chance to be able to watch. It's funny, too, because like one of the main things I gripe about, I went in there and I was like, oh, I actually added on YouTube. I almost never use YouTube, to be honest, but I went in and I added some of those sessions to my watch, quote unquote, watch later list on YouTube, because I was like, this is great, because who knows what I'm going to be in my on the subway and I'm killing time, or I'm on a 4.5 hour ride to New York on a bus, and I got my YouTube right there, and I could just say, what do I have in my watch later? Oh yeah, that session I wanted to see.
Right. Never gonna, that's a perfect example of like, this is, there's an immediate advantage to having the videos in that format that we didn't have before.
Exactly. Yep. Apple should take a lesson from this, at least. I think that people were so excited by the idea that these things were on YouTube. Take the lesson, at least. If somebody's listening from Apple who has anybody knows anybody in that realm, take the lesson that this is another one of those examples. Granted, I know Apple, you folks have lots to do, but this is one of those things that would be a huge win for your developers if we had some way to better make use of these materials that you spent so much money on. I mean, they spent, must have been hundreds of thousands of dollars, ultimately, on making these videos and getting them out there promptly. And they're lying fallow because I can't get to them with the workflows that actually make sense for my day.
Right. Yeah. Well, they made huge progress this year, and maybe we'll see some more improvements along those lines for next WWDC.
You like how, Manton, do you like how I just jump from like total complaints to total gratitude and back again?
Yeah.
Well, I don't even know what lying fallow means. I just looked it up on Google. We'll see if I'm right. Anyway, Manton, this has been a kind of a funny hot weather recording with you. So let's call it a show. And folks, if you get the chance, remember we are a podcast like many others that sort of thrives on reviews and comments in the iTunes infrastructure. So if you enjoy the show, it's great to hear from you on Twitter when you just send us a little ping saying we like the show. It's been great. Keep doing it. But also, please stop into iTunes and leave us a review, a rating, etc. It really helps. It makes our day, really, when we see something new in there, especially if it's positive. So thanks for listening. Manton, I think I will chat with you next week.
All right. See you later.
Take care.